to is a small quantum system that we think can go anywhere. So the experimental setup already is pretty small. It's just about so big. There's lots of people that are trying to make it really, really, really tiny so you can pick it up and take it with you. So it's a defect in diamond. And usually it's thought about as though it was a trapped ion. Think about it as though you had, like you were in Jeff Kimball's lab or Dave Wineland's lab, as though you had an ion captured in a trap and you could address just that one. And of course, if you want to capture an ion in a trap, you have to have a lot of trapping potential. So there's a lot of things you have to pay attention to keep the ion there. And the advantage of the solid state system is that the diamond lattice is going to keep this defect right where we want it, and it's going to be a very clean system. So diamond has a crystal structure that looks like this. Keeps repeating around. Okay, so we have our single crystal. Of diamond. You can use commercial diamonds to look for these things. You know that if you look at diamonds, there are lots of different colored diamonds, and they have many different wonderful properties, right? So diamond can be a semiconductor with a big band gap, so we can use it for electronics. It has a very high thermal conductivity, so it is used a lot for cooling chips. But we prefer to grow it. So we grow it by CVD, so chemical vapor deposition. And we grow it as a single crystal in a very thin plane. It's a two-dimensional sample, and it's big. It's a few millimeters by a few millimeters by something really small, a few hundred microns. We have this two-dimensional beautiful piece of diamond. And if you grow, and of course, I should have said, but at every vertex here, there's a carbon. And of course, carbon comes in two flavors. Most of it is carbon-12, which has no spin. Then we have 1%, that is carbon-13, which is spin 1/2. So occasionally there'll be a spin, but mostly the diamond lattice is very clean. Now, when you grow diamond, it's very hard to keep nitrogen out. If you have the cleanest gases that you want, you'll still have a little bit of nitrogen in there. And so there'll occasionally be a location where you have a nitrogen replacing a carbon. And of course, nitrogen only wants 3 bonds, right? Carbon wants 4 bonds. And so it disrupts the lattice. Now, nitrogen comes in two flavors as well. There's nitrogen 14 and nitrogen 15. And nitrogen 14 is spin 1. And nitrogen 15 is spin 1/2. Nitrogen 14 is by far the most abundant. So this is what we normally see. So if there's a nitrogen, and then there's this challenge that hey, it only wants 3 bonds, then we end up with a vacancy here. And so the defect we're talking about is the so-called nitrogen vacancy defect. And when you have a little bit of nitrogen in your sample, all you need to do is heat it up for a while. So thermally process it, and the nitrogen and the vacancy will find each other and they'll create the defect. Now, there's lots and lots and lots of other types of defects in a diamond, but this is the only one that we're interested in. Although there's lots of types of defects, and you know, there's just lots of numbers of defects, that's just because Avogadro's number is big. If we are looking at, in a clean, nice sample, how many defects we have, well, we may have one every couple hundred microns, okay? And that's a linear dimension. Or in some samples, we may have to go millimeters to find one. We try to avoid those samples. Okay, so we have lots of these defects in diamonds, but they're very, very far apart from each other. And so we can think about these as isolated defects. Now, if we have our single crystal of diamond as this planar sample, if we have just grown it in CVD and there was a little bit of nitrogen around that was unavoidable, then of course the NV centers will be randomly positioned, not only in XY but also in depth. But it's tempting to put the defects close to the surface, because if I could put the defect close to the surface, then it's going to interact with what's on the surface. And so we can make a small quantum processor that is going to, well, I need to tell you a little bit more. We have this NV defect. And of course, again, it's a nitrogen replacing a carbon, so their electron spins are hanging around. And we'll show you how it happens. But effectively, we end up with the electron spin here. It's a spin one. I know. You all taken nuclear physics, and you can tell me, you know, electrons come in spin one half, right? And now I tell you, I have a spin one electron. But it's embedded in a solid state material, okay? So what it's going to look like is it's going to look like an effective spin one electron. So, you know, you could put the word effective. But for everything that we can do spectroscopically, it's an electron that has spin one. And so since it has spin, well, certainly it's going to be sensitive to magnetic fields. That's just if I have a static magnetic field. And of course, if I put this in a big magnetic field, it doesn't matter where the defect is in the diamond. You'll see that. But to look on the surface, then there are dipolar interactions. And that's going to be with surface electrons or nuclear spins. And so if we have an electron-electron interaction, we would call that a dipole interaction. If we had an electron-nuclear interaction, we typically call that the hyperfine interaction, right? And so we'll have two terms of the Hamiltonian. We'll end up with the dipolar and the hyperfine. Now, it's a spin one, effectively. So it'll also interact with an electric field gradient. And so we can look at strain effectively induced there. Okay, so we have the small quantum system cleanly embedded in the diamond. At room temperature, it has really good coherence effects. So at room temperature, it's a long coherence. And the nicest thing about it is that it's optically active. It's very hard to detect a single spin magnetically. It's been done. But it's a low temperature physics experiment because you have to control the noise. But to detect a single spin optically, that's actually a pretty old experiment, and that's easy. So we're going to show you that there's an optical degree of freedom in this that allows us to control the spin. So this is going to give us good state preparation. Good coherent control. Good measurement, so high fidelity measurement, also high visibility. And of course, we could start to think about using this for things like quantum repeaters. It opens up the potential to use to build a quantum repeater. I'll show you how that works as well. Now, there are some people that are suggesting, oh, we can just use it for a quantum computer itself. And so if we look at this local processor, well, the local processor first has the spin 1. So we get the electron gives us a qutrit. And then if we have nitrogen 14, which is general, but it doesn't have to be, then we get another qutrit. And then if I have some adjacent carbons, then I get a couple of qubits. And right now, we can find samples with 2 or 3 local carbons. I'll explain to you why that's limited. But of course, the carbons need to be C13, right? And most, 99% of the time, it will be C12. So it's not very hard to go around and find a defect where locally there's one C13. It's a bit harder to find 2. And it's really painful to find 3. But you can do that. Okay. So we've got this nice little system, and let's figure out a little bit of the physics behind it. And most of the physics comes from looking at the most of the interesting physics comes from looking at this as effective spin 1. Yeah, you have a question.
So what is the typical coherence time?
So it varies a lot from center to center. A few hundred microseconds for the electron T1. The associated nuclear spins, seconds. And, you know, if you have a really nice electron spin, it can be, you know, long as milliseconds.
What about the gate time?
So, depends on which gate you're talking about, but if we're talking about the energy splitting of the electron spin, it's 3 gigahertz. Mm-hmm. If we're looking at the hyperfine interaction to the nuclear spins, the C13, it depends on which one we're talking about, but the strongest ones are 130 megahertz. Yeah. Okay, so let's put down an energy level diagram. So we start off looking at the spin one part of the electron spin. And this energy separation is, as I said, 3 gigahertz. And that piece is effectively a zero field splitting. And we'll see where it comes from in a second, but let's just put it down. So we have omega zero field splitting. And it's going to look like SZ squared. Okay, so you can see that from this piece, these two energy levels are degenerate, right? And M sub S is, of course, the magnetic quantum number of the electron spin, which we usually denote by S. And so we have 0 and plus or minus 1. There's an electronic excited state. In A and E, if you've seen those and you know something about Russell-Saunders coupling, they mean something to you. If you haven't seen it, it just indicates the symmetry of the electronic wave function and the multiplicity. And we can just use them as labels, okay? So if we excited from the MS equals zero state in the A manifold to the E manifold, then it would fall down and it would emit a photon. And this is at about 632 nanometers. So it's visible light, we can detect it. And it's a good cycling photon, cycling transition. If I excite it, it'll fall down. And I can't excite from the zero state to the one state, because I would have to flip a spin. So that's not a loud transition. So we can just cycle here. And we can get photons. Of course, if I excite it from the plus or minus one manifold to the plus or minus one manifold, the same thing would happen. We would have a cycling transition. And so we can get photons out. And so far, it doesn't sound so good, actually. But I've put three states there. And you told me, hey, electrons are spin 1/2 particles. So the way we're going to think about this is we have two electrons, each spin 1/2. And I'm going to introduce an exchange interaction between the electrons. And I'm going to drop the Kronecker product, and I'm going to drop the labels, but electron 1, electron 2, yeah? Just so it doesn't get too messy. Now, if I have this Hamiltonian, then we can rewrite this Hamiltonian in terms of the raising and lowering operator. So remember that sigma plus minus is equal to sigma x plus minus I sigma y. So now if I rewrite this, we see why it's called an exchange interaction. That if I have the two electron spins anti-aligned, then they can both flip, right? So clearly here, let's just look at what happens. If I have the state 1, 1, under this Hamiltonian, it stays where it is. If I have the state 1 up, down, it goes to down, up. If there's a state down, up, it goes to up, down. And of course, if I have the state down, down, it goes to down, down. And so these two energy levels are connected by the exchange interaction. And the reason we call it exchange isn't because it exchanges these two energy levels, but that if I exchange the labeling on the spin, if I took A and B here and I swapped them, well, if I label this A and B and I swap them, I get the same state back and the same thing here, right? But if I swap these, then I go from that. So the exchange interaction is an exchange of those labeling. But of course, it also exchanges those states. Okay, and as it exchanges those states, effectively it mixes these two, and we're going to end up driving ourselves into the triplet manifold. So we go from these levels to, well, this one stays as it is, this one stays as it is, these get mixed, and we get to a state that is up, down, plus down, up, and we'll keep the normalization if I can remember to do it. Right, we get the symmetric and anti-symmetric pieces of this. So we go from having four energy levels to having our triplet states . All right, so this is the symmetric one. And over here, sitting off by itself, is the poor singlet, which also still has that energy. So I come back to this diagram. And I want to put in the singlet states. I'll put them in over here. Now, if we look at these states, what we'll find is that when we excite from here, there's a small probability that there'll be what's called an intersystem crossing, that instead of falling down here, one third of the time, they'll have this intersystem crossing. Now fall over into a singlet manifold, which then decays. It actually does decay radiatively. I mean, gives off a photon. But we almost never look for that photon. And then it ends up down here in the MS equals zero manifold. Now I have to warn you here that here I've made a picture, and over here I've made a picture that says I have two electrons that do this. In fact, if we look at the number of electrons involved in this physics, it's six electrons. And so things get really complicated. And in fact, although the system is used a lot for quantum information processing, we actually don't know all of the details of what goes on with all of those six electrons. Okay, and that's a bit of a challenge of solid state, right? That in solid state, you've got to worry about this lattice. And if it was a clean lattice without a defect, we could tell you everything about it. But there's really a defect there. And so we don't have, you know, until you guys build us a quantum computer, we don't have some way of calculating everything that goes on. But this physics is correct as far as I've said it, okay? And everything that we see falls into this model. So we'll continue with the model, but I want to tell you all of this, the complexities that go on with this system. Okay. Now, Let's look at the advantage of this before I show you some more physics. If we were looking at the information, well, first, let's just look at state preparation. We said that we can do state preparation here. So I start off with my diamond somewhere in this manifold, right? This is a big energy. So I know that I'm going to be somewhere down here. And all I do is apply light to it. And what will happen? Well, if I'm in the zero manifold, I'll cycle back and forth in the zero manifolds. If I'm in the one manifold, I'll cycle back and forth here until by accident I transition over here. In which case, I'll fall down into the zero manifold, and from then on, I'll simply cycle in the zero manifold. So simply by turning on light, I already force myself to end up in the MS equals zero state. And so we have a very simple way of preparing a state. Yeah.
You said you don't usually look for that
photon.
It's
yeah.
The faster of the
daytime, we just wait, right? We have one center we're looking at. The times here are about 20 nanoseconds to fall down, and this time is about 300 nanoseconds. So if we wait a few microseconds, we leave the light on for a few microseconds, we end up down here. So what you have to do is leave the light on for a few microseconds, you end up in the zero manifold, then wait a few more nanoseconds, tens of nanoseconds, so that if you stopped up here, you would end up down here. Yeah? Okay, so now we have our system. It's prepared. And let me tell you one more piece, and then we'll go and look at some of that physics more carefully. It turns out that we don't need to excite on resonance. If instead of exciting with 532, or 632, I excite way up here, I put in a photon that takes, that's, I think, 537, around 540 nanometers, go way up, then there's lots of levels there. And something complex will happen. I have no clue. But if I started off at zero, it will quickly fall down to this state. And then the rest of the physics will be exactly as I described. And the same thing is true for the plus minus one state. If I kick them way up, something complex will happen, but they'll fall down here quickly. And then the rest of the physics will be just like I described. And the reason that I want to do that is it allows me to separate out the excitation and detection scheme. So experimentally, what we're going to do is we're going to study this in the near field so that we can see just one defect. Okay. So some decades ago, Jan Schmidt took a small light pipe and he broke it off. They had a small fiber. And he looked in just the near field here. He was looking at a sample, in this case of anthracene. And what he said was that if he's looking at a small enough volume, and he knows that there are very few defects in his system, then mostly he'll have no defects, and very occasionally he'll have one. And he'll scan around until he finds that one. And when he finds that one, he'll look at the telegraph noise on this system. And we're going to do something that's a little bit more flexible, but the same idea of what Jan did. So we're going to look at a confocal microscope. So we have a source. And the way a confocal microscope is normally described is we put the source through a pinhole. Which, of course, creates a focal spot, right? And then if I have a focal spot, the light will spread from there. We'll put the lens, and now it will focus down. And I'll put my sample here so that by rastering the sample, I can move the focal spot around. Since I'm looking at a focal spot of something like 500 nanometers, then the focal spot has a width of about a micron. Yeah? If we do our optics right. So that would be focal microscopy. But now we have confocal microscopy. So it says, oh yes, this defect here is going to emit light. When it emits light, it's going to go back through the same path. But I'm going to put a mirror here. Another pinhole in a detector out here. And what we require of this mirror is that it's dichromic, so that what it's going to do is it says, hey, pass the 540. But reflect the 630. Okay? And that is, in fact, an easy optical device to get. And now you can see that we can make our confocal arrangement really, really simple. With just this complexity, then we can raster the sample around, find a diamond. When we find a diamond, the detector will be bright. Okay? When we find a diamond, we find a defect in the diamond. The diamond's not so hard to find. Though they are transparent. If you drop them on the floor, they're gone. But, okay, so now we have a nice little confocal system that allows us. Now, formally, this is a good description. In practice, what we do is instead of moving the sample in all three dimensions, we move it only in one dimension, and I scan a set of mirrors here to scan over the sample. It's just faster. But think about it this way, because this is the most compact representation of the confocal system. So what did we get? We said, yes, by exciting above the excited state, then we can take advantage of these two colors, and of course, therefore, we can have a detection. And you would say, well, why was it important? Why don't I just detect it at the color of the laser that I'm putting here? Well, there's always lots of scatter, right? And so here we're saying, when the system goes through the cycling transition, we get at most one photon. And then you look at the light fields coming from this laser, you know, which has some crazy power, like 10 milliwatts. And we're getting so many photons from that we would never be able to detect the one photon from our sample in the background of all the scattered light from the other. It becomes a much, much, much more difficult experiment. So here we make our life simple by choosing these two colors. Now, having said that, and I'll say, this is an avalanche diode photodetector, and it easily detects one photon. Now, of course, I said we get at most one photon. In fact, we don't get as many as one photon, because this center here, when it emits a photon, it's going to emit a photon in all directions with equal probability. And so only those photons that are by accident detected with momentum that takes them to this lens will ever find their way to the detector. So we lose a big factor there, something like 1,000. Maybe not quite that much, but almost that much. So this piece is not very efficient, but that's okay. That's just the measurement visibility. Good. Okay, so now how do we differentiate here between being in the 0-1 state? Right? I'd like to use the photon to tell me if I'm in the 0 manifold or I'm in the 1 manifold. And so if we look at the intensity versus time, so I'm just going to integrate the photon intensity versus time. Well, if I'm in the 0 manifold, it's always a cycling transition, right? So it's always giving me a photon. If I'm in the 1 manifold, plus or minus 1, well, it doesn't always give me a photon. It gives me a photon 2/3 of the time, right? So it says, hey, 2/3 of the time, plus or minus 1 falls down to plus or minus 1. 1/3 of the time, it falls over to the intersystem crossing, right? So this says, okay, so we have a slope here that's 2/3 of the other, right? But then, of course, what happens is it falls down into the 1 manifold. And so eventually the slope becomes the same as the MS equals 0 manifold, right? Because we end up in the MS equals 0 manifold. So if we started in 1, we have this difference. And you can see here that we have a little bit of contrast in the system. And so we can use this difference as a contrast to tell us if we're in the 0 state or the 1 state. So if I detect for some time and I find, my counts are up here, then I say, yes, I'm in the 0. Or if I detect them down here, I say, no, I'm in 1. And so we can separate those two. Now, there's a nice optimization, which we won't go through. But, you know, what's the noise in the intensity? The noise in the intensity is the square root of the number of counts, right? Just the Poissonian statistics. So if I look for a short time, then it looks like I have a bigger separation per unit time. But, of course, the noise is going to be bigger. If I count too long, well, then I end up having no separation, right? Because effectively, all I'm going to be doing is counting in the 0 manifold out here. Okay, so although the statistics would be better, the contrast to noise would be worse. And so we can optimize the contrast to noise. But anyways, by doing the confocal piece with the two separate colors, we can now differentiate whether we're in the 0-1 state. And so if we're thinking of DaVincenzo's requirements, we get two of them already. We've got the piece that says, yes, I can prepare a state, and I can do a qubit selective measurement. Now, it's incumbent upon us to prove that we have only one defect in our sample, right? Here, we have some big volume that is micron cubed. And there are lots and lots of atoms in a cubic micron, right? 10 to the 11. So then we say, I've got this micron cubed. Now then, what do I want to do? I want to prove that I have only one defect here. And we can do this by the Hanbury-Brown twist method, which is just, we can understand it perfectly classically. Or you can look at a nice quantum description as well. We don't even need it. So I take my beam here, and I send it to a 50-50 splitter. So this is the photons coming out, going that way. Go to a 50-50 splitter. And then I have two detectors. So they're both good detectors. And then we have some electronic line that goes to a coincidence counter. And all this does is it says, did those two detectors fire at the same time? Okay? So you get an output of this coincidence. Yes, no, that says the same time. Now, this doesn't help us too much unless we put in one more knob, which is delay. So we'll call that tau. So the idea is I get a photon coming in here. And with this 50-50 beam splitter, I'm going to send it to one of these two detectors. And it's going to be randomly sent to one of those two detectors, right? That's what this beam splitter does. And of course, we don't need to talk about any coherence here. We're making a projective measurement at those. That's why the classical description works so well. It says, yeah, okay, it arrives here, it arrives here. If it arrives at one of those two, we detect it. Our quantum efficiency is very high. Now, this path length and this path length may not be exactly the same. So we need some way of calibrating this. So what we do is electrically we put in a delay that says, we'll call that A and B. It says delay B a little bit. Okay? And then we look at the coincidence. And of course, what do we see? So this is tau. And I'm going to put here this magic time where they really are correctly set. We don't know what that is, but there is some time that they're really correctly set. Well, if we're way over here, then this is emitting photons all the time, right? So it'll emit some photon. It'll come here. This one is firing much later than that one. Another photon comes by. It arrives at this detector. Okay, and we see that there's a coincidence. But it doesn't mean that the timing event was the same. It just means that there's continuously photons coming here, and they're randomly going to those two detectors. And so we're nicely up here, and we're nicely up here. And then if we have only one emitter, then it only gives off one photon. It gives off one photon. That photon has to go here or here. Right? One photon, one detector can fire. So when we've set this correctly, then we see this dip in the coincidence. If we see this dip, then we say, only one defect. And, of course, we don't know that time. So we just run through a set of times. We see a dip or not. If we see a dip, we label it as zero. We say, oh, yeah, now we've found the correct setting of our coincidence counter. And if we don't see a dip, then we say, we've got two or more defects there, and we scan around until we find the next one and throw that one away. Yeah? Good. Now, there is a lot of nice physics in the shape of this. So, I mean, that's something that one could look at in a quantum optics course. But for our purposes, it's just a tool. It says, yes, we have one center, or we have none. We have more than one, and we can perfectly tell that. Okay. Yeah.
Going back to the first diagram, is the point of that setup in order to do this coincidence pattern, or to figure out the defects, or do you want to know like the length of time it takes until you have your prepared system?
So you're talking about this diagram.
Right.
So the point of this diagram is to define a focal volume for both the excitation and the detection, so that we're detecting the photons from exactly the same volume that we're exciting them in, and that for both of those the volume is small. And what enables that is that we have these two colors. Okay, so. You can see that at this lens, you want it to treat all light the same way. And the two wavelengths aren't that different anyways. This mirror separates those. And I don't tell you, but an important point here is that we effectively chop this signal so that when we're detecting, in fact, we turn that off. But there's lots of details to this. But this is important. If we just shine light on a diamond, you get all sorts of colors back. And if you're looking at it with a microscope, you can see lots and lots of different point defects giving you brilliant, colorful result. And so we need to say, no, we don't want all of that, because then we would have a distribution of defects, we would have a distribution of orientations. I didn't say that, but of course, the nitrogen has to appear in the lattice. And you can see that once the nitrogen is there, then there's lots of places that the vacancy can go into, that four. And so we end up having a distribution of physics, because the nitrogen vacancy axis defines a preferred axis. And so every time we find a diamond with a defect, every time we find a defect in a diamond, we have to spend some time to figure out which way that vector is pointing. And if we had an ensemble of defects and we tried to deal with them all at once, then each defect would be slightly different, and so we would end up with an incoherence like this prism in the neutron interferometer, and we wouldn't be able to keep the coherence in the system. So we really do want one defect, and that's what we use the confocal piece for. Okay. So let's go back to this piece here. So I care about the details of this physics, because the details of that physics is going to show us why we can get this intersystem crossing. And so we define a Hamiltonian that is That's this. That says, look, I've got this exchange coupling. And I have an energy difference here. So these two terms compete with each other. Right? They compete with each other because the first term says, these have different energies. Right? The second term says, no. I keep swapping them, so I equilibrate those energies. They don't have different energies. And the first term I could leave out. It's a little bit boring. But it just shifts those energy levels. Okay? And the reason I put it in there is we know that nothing interesting is going to happen with those. And so by putting some big energy there, I just move them out of the way. We don't have to look at them. Okay? Everything interesting happens here. And if we go and simply look at the eigenspectrum of this. So we just take the same Hamiltonian, and instead of, it's easy enough to analytically calculate the energy spectra, but these days I don't see any reason to bother. Okay, so we define the Hamiltonian just as I've defined it up there. We end up, of course, with a matrix for the Hamiltonian. This is written in the sigma z basis, right? So I'm assuming that sigma z is a good quantum number, in which case, of course, the omega e terms, exchange terms, are off the diagonal, okay? Because they're, of course, in a different basis. And now let's just look at the energy level. So we have here, I've plotted the energy of the four eigenstates. On this axis, I've changed the exchange coupling strength. So that's the omega E term from 0 to plus or minus 100. These two levels are simply the omega piece. They don't matter. Right? Those also, this is down, that's up. And let's be clear about this. We know that at the end we're going to fall into these two states. And if I look at these two states, let's call this plus and call that minus. And then if I look at the energy, right, of the plus state or the energy of the minus state, where this is the exchange interaction, then this is going to be plus 2 omega e. I put a factor of half there. Plus omega e. This is going to be minus omega e. So if I look at this diagram, then we've got the plus state sitting over here. So this is the state up, plus down. I'm going to drop all of the normalization. And that's the minus state. And now I'm going to introduce some of the delta z, delta omega term. Right? So I'm going to introduce a competing term that's going to put some energy difference between those. And you nicely see that, of course, you get an anti-crossing. In this anti-crossing here, you see this because in this range, the system is quantized along the z-axis, right? Delta omega is bigger than the exchange energy. So over here, sigma z is a good quantum number. Over here, sigma z is not a good quantum number, right? The parity of the state, the symmetry of the state, is a good quantum number. Yeah? And so you have that splitting there. And of course, what happens, so let's draw it like this, is the states really do continue, right? So this state over here is the plus state, and this state is the minus state. And by mixing those two, we get exactly what we want, right? That here, the state is that, and here the state is that. And you say, oh yes, what happens is I go from the positive state, and it connects through the Zeeman state into the anti-symmetric state, or vice versa. And how many of you have gone through Zener-Landau, or Landau-Zener, Stuckelberg? No one. No one's looked at, okay. We'll find a moment to go through it. But imagine, here, we have the exchange term. Imagine that was an experimental parameter. Then I could start off over here. And if I moved to the right slowly, I would follow this curve. But if I moved to the right quickly, I would make that transition and I would end up over here. So based upon how we control this parameter as a function of time, we can control where our state ends up. And if we're clever about it, in fact, we can end up in a coherent superposition of those two states. Okay, and so it's worth looking at these transition probabilities. You've all looked at adiabatic processes, yeah? No? Maybe? And so the adiabatic limit is the easy one to describe. Okay, now I'm going to stop because we've run out of time. But what I wanted to show you is that when we look at the transition probabilities here, in the case that I have the ideal system, this term isn't there, then the transition probabilities, just apply Fermi's golden rule, says there's no transitions between these, there's no transitions between these. And then I relax Fermi's golden rule. There's a statement in solid-state physics that there are no not allowed transitions in the solid state. In quantum optics, things are in atomic physics, things are allowed and not allowed, and it's really true. In solid-state physics, because we've got that diamond lattice, everything happens. So we say, if I take and I add a little bit of a difference between those two electron spins. I allow the lattice, the diamond lattice, to distinguish those two electron spins just a little bit. These transitions become weakly allowed. This transition stays forbidden. Okay? And so that's why when we have this inter-system crossing, it only goes this way. This never connects. And it's not because I've drawn it that there's a positive energy. In fact, we don't really know where that is. And if it was down here and it looks downhill, it still wouldn't happen. It's not allowed by the symmetry of the problem. So we'll look at that and give you a little bit more physics. Let me show you the rest of this notebook. I give you the notebook. Of course, as I increase delta omega, that anti-crossing separation becomes larger. Look, when delta omega is equal to zero, this is really a crossing. Now, if I come down all the way to the bottom here, now I look at the spectrum of this. And so we say, I have four lines. And every piece that is that flips one spin is an allowed transition. So if I'm over here in this basis states, so that delta omega is big, then this transition is allowed because we flipped the B spin. Right? This transition is allowed because we flipped the A spin. This transition is allowed, this transition is allowed. This one is not, right? Because we had to flip two spins. And this one is not, again, because we had to flip two spins. So we expect four lines. And in the limit that the Zeeman interaction is all that controls the system, they should have equal amplitude. And so what I've calculated here is the spectrum that you would see for that. And we see four lines because there are four transitions. They each have a little different energy. And you can see already, for whatever parameters I set there, that there's an asymmetry in the amplitude. And that asymmetry in the amplitude comes directly from Fermi's golden rule. It comes directly from saying that, we're not entirely in this manifold. We're a little bit in these manifolds. And now the selection rules change. And now let me take and decrease delta omega. So as I decrease delta omega, these two will come closer together. As they come closer together, the exchange energy is more important. And you can see that the asymmetry in the peak heights becomes more pronounced. At some point, the two inner lines coalesce into one line. And the outer lines, they stop moving in. They simply go to zero. Okay, and that's the transition to having the system in this manifold where there are two transitions, but they're degenerate. And there are no transitions to this system, right? And so what we see is this one peak, okay? And so you can go through, have a look at those calculations. We will start tomorrow by going ahead and looking at the physics of what's allowed and what's not allowed in these two manifolds of the exchange interaction, and finally clean up this idea that, yes, in fact, we have something that started life as two electrons but ends up looking like one electron that is a spin one instead of a spin one half. Okay, any questions? Okay, then I'll see you tomorrow morning.